Good morning. It's a pleasure to introduce our first invited speaker of the day, and it's a pleasure to have her here. I'm sure this will be an extremely entertaining talk. The first speaker is Dr. Sonia Kotz, who is the chair in cognitive and affective neuroscience at the University of Manchester and section head of cognitive neuroscience and experimental psychology, as well as research group leader at the Max Planck Institute for Human Cognitive and Brain Sciences in Leipzig, which means that she's a very busy person and does a lot of traveling. And her talk today is entitled Neural and Temporal Correlates of L2 Speech and Language Processing Beyond the Expected. Sonia.
So good morning, everyone. I'm excited to see some bright-eyed faces so early in the morning. And while I'm trying to get to my talk, I would like to take the opportunity to really thank Karsten for putting this incredible meeting together. I think we all agree that it's been already very enlightening. It's been exciting to have such a forum for talking about multilingualism and bilingualism. So I think we need that, and hint, hint, this should be something to be considered for the future. But it is also my great pleasure to talk today about speech, which is really a topic that belongs into the School of Communication and Speech Disorders that celebrates its 50th anniversary. So it's a particular pleasure for me to speak at this point in time about actually speech and language processing and how it relates to second language acquisition. So rather than talking about bilingualism per se, I would like to focus on late learners of a second language. And this is rather important to me because I think we need to very much differentiate between bilinguals and late learners. And some of these issues have been addressed yesterday, so I won't be harping on them again today. So let me start out with a statement that says, time must flow for sound to exist. This kind of introduction is rather important for the work that I will be talking about today, because if you look at the waveform and the spectrogram of a speech example, evidence on the left-hand side, what we see in the end is a continuum of sound. And per se, we can't really decipher what the elements are that really constitute this kind of a waveform. But if you look at the waveform per se, what you see is that there are ups and downs, there are breaks in between. And I think what is rather important in our understanding of auditory language processing is that we can't separate it from speech. Because speech allows us to actually encode relevant information, linguistic information, in time. And this comes along with its own properties, because speech sounds, words that we constitute from speech sounds, have a particular temporal resolution. They're separated by pauses. So between the sounds and the pauses, what we have is what I would want to call temporal order. So you could say, well, why ask that question? Because in the end, this is all inherent. But I think it's wrong. Because, as a matter of fact, when the system gets under stress, like it may be when we encounter learning a second language, or as a matter of fact, when we encounter something like a stroke, where the system breaks down, we very easily can see that there are dissociations between the temporal properties of speech and the linguistic function that is embedded in the speech signal. And so I think looking at these two aspects that constitute speech and lead us to language, auditory language comprehension, is rather an important point. Oops. So let me focus right away on what I would like to talk to you about today. and that is asking the question, why speech rhythm? And that has been mentioned in a couple of talks yesterday already, is important in understanding auditory language processing. And I think this beautiful schema has been around for ages, and I think rather disregarded in a lot of the research that's been going on in terms of auditory language processing, with some very good exceptions, including the seminal work of Karsten on prosody and syntax interfaces. But I think what this tells us is that in terms of speech structuring, we have something like a hierarchy that may remind you of sorts what we have in syntax as well. And what you can see, indeed, is that an utterance really breaks down into intonational phrases, phonological words. And while we've seen more and more evidence in the literature on the interface of intonational phrases and aspects such as syntax processing, the focus of today will be down here, and that is the lowest level of segmenting speech input, and that is what I would want to call the basic metric pattern that constitutes a speech rhythm. So in the straightforward terminology, this would be called the metric foot. And this metric foot actually varies indeed as a function of different languages that we encounter when they're spoken. And I think you've heard that very nicely elaborated on yesterday in terms of stress time languages, syllable time languages, mora time languages. So the big question that we want to ask here is, next to facilitating speech segmentation and really playing a major role in word recognition, so where's the boundary of one word relative to the next? The big question is, if that kind of a principle applies to speech processing in general, does it also deliver on a higher level account when we're processing more complex information such as syntax? And so the idea is really that by using speech rhythm, we actually have a facilitator that allows us to segment speech, not just in word units, but potentially also into larger units that may in the end allow us to really facilitate when speech processing or language processing becomes more difficult. All right. So I guess the next critical question that one would be asking is, what may rhythm and syntax have in common? And I think in a very simplistic way that clearly needs to be elaborated, we can make the assumption that both organize the speech flow. And I think we can break this down a little bit further in talking about both are based on prediction. That is, if you look at a simple syntactic combination of an article and a noun, we talked a little bit about gender yesterday, what you know is if there's an article, there's got to be a noun following this, because this is a predictor of a word category. If you encounter a verb after an article, something is wrong. Okay? So there's a very basic principle of a formal prediction. But when we start looking into rhythm, I think based on what I tried to introduce is that we have a second type of prediction coming along, which I would want to call globally a temporal prediction. And that is the alteration of stressed and unstressed syllables, for example, in a stress time language, will make a prediction about when the next event will occur. And while in natural speech this is never completely like that, stressed and unstressed, stressed and unstressed, we actually played with that kind of a principle to understand whether these two principles actually interact. And in the following, I will be talking about when predictions, those are the ones that are encoded in time, such as speech rhythm, and what predictions. And today I will be focusing at particular syntactic phenomena. And the big question is, do they interact or not? But before I get to that bigger question and some of the data points, I think it's rather important to show you that the neural correlates of rhythm and syntax processing in particular actually share quite a lot of common ground in the brain. So I just ranged a couple of the players that are rather important here, including the anterior and posterior superior temporal gyrus, the inferior frontal gyrus, the bilateral insulae. But here are a couple of players, such as the SMA, the basal ganglia, the thalamus, and the cerebellum, that we actually classically know a lot more about in terms of motor behavior, general timing behavior. So these are kind of more general types of systems. And the question is, why do they pop up when speech and language become difficult? Again, in the context of bilingualism or second language acquisition, that is a critical question. But there's another question that comes along with that. Namely, the basal ganglia have been very much discussed in their function as a control mechanism in bilingualism. When people switch languages, when they have difficulties processing the information. And so beyond what I'm going to be talking about today, what we may need to consider is that there is differentiation within these structures. And I'm not going to be talking about this today, but I'm happy to elaborate on it later on, that may transfer into cortical correlates of speech and language as well. So the cognitive side of things, relative to maybe the more basic temporal side of things, may be differentiated within that system. And this is something that clearly should get further attention in future research. So I think it's about time that I started talking about some data to keep your attention this morning. And so what I would like to actually put forward is that we're looking into a potential functional parallelism between syntax and rhythm processing. And I will give you some evidence from ERP studies that we've done, as well as from functional neuroimaging, and how this actually translates into second language acquisition. But we have been working a lot, as you've heard yesterday, in terms of ERP research with violations of expectancies. And so one critical question that one can argue may be a good one to ask is, well, do we make these types of errors in real life, or is that really just a measure for us to test some principles that we're interested in? So we actually try to push this a little bit further by looking into what we want to call syntactic uncertainties or syntactic ambiguities, and see even at a level of syntactic processing, when we don't encounter errors, do we see similar kinds of interactions or facilitation effects of the speech rhythm, and we looked at that both as a function of monolingual language processing and L2 language processing. But since we try to push ourselves a little bit further, I would like to share some initial data that we've collected more recently about the impact of rhythm as a domain general principle. And I'll keep you posted on that until I get there. So let's get going. I think just for a quick indication, these are the tools that we're working with, and we have heard a lot about ERP, so I don't have to really introduce them anymore. But the component of interest today is not going to be the N400, but the P600, which is really a response to expectancy violations and how can we fix them. But in the context of syntactic ambiguity processing, it's also been an indicator of processing difficulties or effort to process particular syntactic structures. So this is a nice component that mimics a lot of issues of interest here. I'm going to quickly introduce you to the paradigm that we worked with, and that is we used simple German sentences such as Gina, I can't even do that this morning. Okay, so whoever speaks German will know what I'm talking about. But the long and the short of it is, this is a correct German sentence. It's more for syntactically marked, as you will see at the verb. And what we did is the following. Participants listened to four types of sentences that I will introduce a bit more specifically just in a minute. And we had two tasks. One time, participants focused on the syntactic components of the sentences, so they were asked whether the sentence was syntactically correct or incorrect. And the other time, we asked whether the sentence was rhythmically coherent or not. So we were after having an option to look at syntax and rhythmic processing one time in an explicit manner and the other time in an implicit manner, because that may tell us something about how automatically we can actually deal with this type of information. So now some sentence examples, and here it will become a little bit more clear. So sentences were constituted of two-syllabic words, which constitutes a natural evolution of stressed and unstressed syllables in German. So you will say, okay, that never happens in real life. You're totally right. But for the purpose of trying to see whether there is an interface between these two mechanisms, it was rather important to play this out. And it's a perfectly normal, a good sentence in German. And to convince you that this didn't sound like a metronome, I'm going to let you listen to this. Even if it's German, if it plays now. It worked before. Mm-hmm. It doesn't anymore. Okay, it's let's do it again.
Vera hätte Christoph gestern Morgen duzen können.
Okay, so what you actually see is that the timing of the words, the pauses between the words, is completely natural speech. But embedded in the signal is a very distinct alternation of stressed and unstressed syllables. So then we had a condition where we actually violated the syntactic expectancy. So in this case, we changed the morphological marking. The expected ending would have been duzen, but we have duzte, which is a morphological marker that relates to not a plural, but a singular. Then we had a rhythmically incorrect condition where we simply shifted the stress pattern from the expected pattern of stressed, unstressed to unstressed, stressed. But the syntactic marking was correct. And of course, if you're after looking into an interaction of the two mechanisms, you use a double violation, and this is what we did in the fourth condition. So the hypotheses are very straightforward. What we expect for a morphological expectancy violation is at least a P600 that has been introduced to you before. The bigger question was, if there are shared principles between these rhythmic expectancies and the syntactic expectancies, would we see a similar kind of P600 or positivity response when indeed the stress pattern shifted? And last but not least, if there's an interaction between these two, we should see a similar strength interaction effect in the P600 for these double violations. And here are the results. We can actually flip through these rather quickly. I will always show you an exemplar electrode from the syntax task, followed by the rhythmic task. For the syntax condition, followed by the rhythm condition, followed by the interactive condition. And what you see here is that under both task conditions, we see an evolution of a P600 that only differs in terms of its latency, most likely as a function of task demands. Okay, so the effect is comparable. And to make a long story short, this pattern repeats itself in the rhythm condition, in the double violation condition. So we have some very first nice evidence that these two principles actually interface and that they lead to similar kinds of brain responses in terms of expectancy violations. And so we were, of course, quite interested to also see what the neural correlates of these are. And what you see here is, again, the same kind of evolution of the syntax task for the syntax rhythm and double violation. And here is something that was rather surprising for us. While you would normally expect at least to see inferior frontal gyrus activation next to temporal cortex activation in the left hemisphere, under this highly rhythmically predictable pattern, we see a very focal activation in the superior temporal gyrus. Now you will ask, where is that activation here? We didn't quite meet the threshold for the double violation condition, but be assured when we lower the threshold ever so slightly, the same kind of pattern occurs. So the important take-home message here is really same pattern across all three conditions, very comparable to what we've seen in the ERP. And here is the result when we focus on the rhythmic task. Now, it looks a lot more bright, and the brain is on fire, but I think the take-home message, again, is completely comparable between the three conditions. Now, what is quite exciting for us in this context is, indeed, that next to the expected activation patterns in terms of frontotemporal activation for syntactic and rhythmic violation conditions, we also see the classical subcortical players that I introduced to you before, including the insula, the SMA, the premotor cortex, and the basal ganglia. So when we focus on the rhythmic properties of auditory speech and language, indeed, the systems that support rhythmic and temporal properties light up, even though this is not a heavily difficult task. Okay? So I think that's another interesting step forward for us. So the big question that we now ask, and it's finally about second language acquisition, is, well, how do these rhythmic patterns actually play into the capacity of a second language learner to deal with the rhythmic properties of the language that he or she is acquiring? And I think there are a couple of very interesting ways to think about this. For example, German, Spanish, and English share what we want to call something like contrastive stress or lexical stress. So umfahren versus umfahren will have a different meaning dependent on where the stress pattern falls. While in French, these two possibilities of contrastive and lexical stress are missing. This is why French is considered to be a syllabled time language. Ooh, time to speed up. All right. It's about time, is it? So, long story short, what we did is to test highly proficient French learners of German who were actually immersed into German because they were studying at the Leipzig University. And what I'm going to show you is the very same evolution of components that I've shown you before, and that is what we see in the second language learners, highly proficient second language learners, is a syntactic response for the double violation and the syntactic violation, but we see absolutely no resonance for the rhythmic shift. So while this result in terms of syntax is really going along with what has been reported in the literature, if second language learners are highly proficient, they seem to be able to deal with syntactic information in their L2 quite nicely, it seems that their sensitivity towards stress patterns is quite distinctly different than what we've seen in the monolingual speakers of German. And when we actually force them into making rhythmic decisions, they fail completely. And they not only fail completely on the rhythm tasks, but they fail on the syntax information processing as well. So it's rather important to understand that the kind of task that you're using when you're testing these participants may be giving you quite a different display of results under those circumstances. So there was something, though, that really bothered us, and this is seen here. So you have a little bit of something going on, even though that didn't reach statistical significance. And we said, well, we rather have to have a look at the performance. And this is what we did. And what you see here now is a split of the sample that we tested. And what we see now, granted this is a post-hoc analysis, as something very, very interesting. And that is, when you look at the low performers, you see that rhythm and syntax are actually very, very low, while correct is up, and the double violation is also a little bit up. But in comparison to high performers, there is really something going on about syntax and rhythm. And when we actually now group the participants based on this performance and look at the ERPs again, this is what we start seeing. And that is, in the rhythm task, when we look at low performers, we see that they absolutely have no differentiation whether something is syntactically correct or incorrect relative to a rhythm shift, whether that's expected or unexpected. But those who actually have very high performance show the effect in both conditions. Now, to make the assumption that French speakers are stress deaf under those circumstances is rather wrong. So what we have to really take into consideration are individual differences, clearly. And just as an incidental evidence, which really, really pleases me immensely, when we talk to these participants afterwards, some of them said, well, we had a very strict German teacher. Now, you know what that means. That kind of a phase. But the teacher was a smart one. The teacher allowed the learners to tap along with the speech rhythm. So by entraining the learning procedure with a sensory motor feedback, it's an intriguing idea to me in terms of thinking how learning may actually come along. This may have facilitated these participants' capacity to actually entrain to the rhythm that is very unusual for them, and it's clearly something that we're further pursuing at this point in time. I'm running out of time, I think, and I'm going to skip something and come to a last data point that I think is rather interesting. I said before, as a little bit of a teaser, we want to understand whether people's rhythmic capacity extends across domains. And what we did with another sample of second language learners, in this case early and late bilinguals of Turkish who had German as their second language, we explored their capacity to process non-linguistic information such as rhythm in music. And so rather than asking the question, does musical aptitude facilitate second language acquisition, we asked the question, if someone is exposed to distinct rhythmic patterns in their L1 and L2, such as Turkish and German, who don't share the same stress class, is their area of rhythmic expertise a lot larger than those learners of a second language that actually share a rhythmic class? And in this case, we're talking about German learners of English. And what you can see in this data point is very nice. Independent of whether Turkish learners of German are early or late learners, they show a stronger musical and rhythmic aptitude as compared to German learners, second language learners of English. So I think this is a very nice set of data that tells us that there may be a lot more common ground, not just between the non-linguistic and the linguistic facets, but even between speech and language and music. And I think with that, I would like to come to an end with a very quick summary of things that I already said so far. I hope I have shown some convincing evidence today that there may be some common ground of structural principles in language extending from syntax to rhythm, that we have to start thinking about a more extended network involving sensory motor areas that support these mechanisms in the brain, that we see that these two principles play a distinctive role when we start into second language acquisition and their distinctive individual profiles, and hopefully we get some more evidence in the near future about shared principle across domains. As usual, this work would never have been possible without some very, very talented and motivated students, including Maren Schmidt-Kassow and Karin Botemich, who is now in Montreal and pursuing her own line of research, and more recently, Paula Runkalia-Dennison, who's done the work on music. And with that, I would like to thank you for your attention.
Can I ask you about, in the stimuli where you're lining up the syntax and the rhythmic violations, do you also have conditions where you have two violations, but they are not lined up? In other words, a rhythmic violation somewhere else so that you can see whether what's going on is just they don't like double ungrammaticality, or whether it's really that there's something about the alignment.
We did that. I didn't get around to the data because I got too entrenched into talking about rhythm. But yes, we did. And the effects are still very comparable. But we went to a higher level where we actually started looking into perceptual groupings. So it didn't always match up with the marking, the syntactic marking. So, yes.
That was great. Thanks. I was just wondering if you have this added rhythmic ability in the Turkish-German bilinguals, and there's shared properties between rhythm and syntax, would they be better at some kind of syntactic processing than the German monolinguals?
Say again?
If you have the shared properties between the rhythm processing and the syntactic processing, and you have this
in
better...
In the Turkish speakers?
Would you find some advantage in the syntactic processing in the Turkish-German bilinguals because of their aptitude?
Yes. As a matter of fact, what we see is a reduction of the P600 to object-first sentences. But this was really an issue of early learners. We don't see a similar kind of effect in the late learners. So there's something that needs to be looked at a little bit more closely because this was the first time that we really saw these age of acquisition effects in a long time. So,
You have this beautiful non-additive pattern in the natives for the double violation case for the P6. When you broke down the L2 groups by their performance, was that also the case for the double violation? You didn't show us the double violation.
Nothing changed there.
It's the same.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks very much.